Part 5. Group 15. Chapter 51. Number 12 sat in his car. He was parked on the opposite side of the road to the church hall. The street was eerily quiet. A battered old minibus was parked directly in front of him, the stenciled sign on its dirty flanks advertising a Camden gym. He had watched the dozen youngsters pile out of the bus and file into the hall, different sizes and ages, all of them carrying sports bags. The local kids had arrived within the space of half an hour, all similarly equipped. Milton's car was parked 50 yards away. Callan had followed the tracking beacon from across London. He had not seen him and assumed that he was inside. His mobile chirped.
I have orders for you.
Callan recognised Control's voice.
Yes, sir.
Do you know where number one is?
He's in the East End. I have him under surveillance now. What do you want me to do?
The committee has reviewed your report. It's been decided that he is a risk we cannot take. His behaviour, his likely mental condition, national security is at risk. We have decided that he needs to be retired.
Callan kept his voice calm and implacable.
Yes, sir. When?
Quickly.
Tonight should be possible.
Very good, 12. Let me know when it is done.
The line went dead. Callan put the phone back into his pocket. He would have preferred a little longer to plan an operation like this, against a target of number one's pedigree, but he didn't think it an impediment that need detain him. Number one had no idea that he had been marked for death. Callan had the benefit of the element of surprise, and that would be the only advantage that he would need. He opened the door, went around to the boot of the car, and popped it open. He pulled up the false floor and ran his gaze across the row of neatly arranged weapons. He reached down and stroked his fingers across the cold metal stock of a combat shotgun. He pulled a bandolier over his shoulder and filled the pouches with shells. He didn't think he'd need more than the two that were already loaded, but it didn't hurt to be prepared. He shut the boot and locked it and got back into the car again. All he needed to do was wait for the right moment. Chapter 52. Milton stood with Rutherford next to the ring, both of them watching the action. Elijah was fighting one of the boys from the Tottenham club. The two of them were well matched. The Tottenham boy was a year older and a little bigger, but Elijah was faster and his punches were crisper, with a natural technique that couldn't be taught.
Boy's doing good,
Rutherford said, his eyes fixed on the action.
Landing everything he throws. If he don't knock him out, he'll take him on points easy.
Milton thought that was probably right, but it didn't mean that he wasn't nervous. His own fists jerked a little with each punch, and he caught himself holding his breath as the other boy moved in tight and clinched, snagging Elijah around the shoulders and hugging him. Elijah tried to struggle free, but the Tottenham boy was strong. The referee called for the break, but before he could step in, the boy released his right hand and punched twice into Elijah's groin. The bell sounded. Elijah spat out his mouthguard.
You hit me low,
he yelled at him.
Yeah,
the boy called back across the ring at him. What you gonna do about it, Acne? Rutherford stepped between the ropes.
Elijah,
I'm gonna fucking duke you.
Rutherford reached out a long arm, snagged the collar of Elijah's singlet, and dragged him back to the corner.
Deep breath, younger.
He hit me in the nuts!
Rutherford put one big hand on each shoulder and turned him away.
Yeah, he did. And you lose your temper like you're fixing to do. Chances are this boy ain't got what it takes to hold you off, and you'll probably knock him out, but losing your temper like that gets to be a bad habit, and eventually you'll come up against someone who's good enough to get you all fired up and take advantage of it. You're good enough to go a long way, younger. Maybe even make a nice career out of it. You don't want to get into bad habits that'll get you in trouble in a fight that really means something. Like for your future. Yeah, I'm saying.
Elijah scowled at the canvas.
Yeah. Now then, you know why I eat you low.
'Cause I'm better than him.
That's right, younger. Better than him. Much better than he'll ever get to be to. There's one more round coming, all right? I'm gonna let you go, and you're gonna get back out there. Touch his gloves in the middle of the ring like you respect him, even though we know you don't. And then you're gonna box him. You keep your cool, follow the plan we talked about, and wait for the opening. When he gives it to you, then you punish him for hitting you low. You got it?
Yeah.
All right, then.
Rutherford pushed the mouthguard back into Elijah's mouth and let go of his shoulder.
Touch his gloves, and away you go.
The bell was rung to signal the start of the third round, and the two boys met in the centre of the ring again. They tapped gloves and then sprang apart. Elijah did exactly as Rutherford had instructed. He kept his opponent at arm's length, stinging him with his jab whenever he tried to get in too close. The older boy tried to rush him, but Elijah skipped out of the way, banging in straight rights and lefts into the side of the boy's face as he sailed harmlessly past. As the seconds wound down, he stepped back and lowered his guard, indicating his chin with a clumsy touch of his glove. He's showboating, Milton thought, a grin breaking out across his face. The other boy swore at the goading, his words muffled by his guard, and rushed in again. Elijah took a step to the side, pivoted on his right foot, and swung a strong right hook into the boy's guts. His momentum was stopped at once, and his guard dropping to shield his stinging ribs, Elijah powered a left hook that knocked him backwards, and, after a comical stumble, he landed on his behind. The bell sounded, and the fight came to an end.
That's my boy, Milton thought, before he caught himself.
Elijah ducked his head to the referee and bumped his right fist against Rutherford's. He turned to look at Milton, but looked away again quickly. Milton nodded at that. Fair enough, he thought. He didn't know anything about what had happened, and as far as he was concerned, he had caught Milton in bed with his mother. All things considered, he deserved his mistrust. A week had passed since the riots. Milton had spent most of the time with Elijah in the hospital. Sharon's condition had stabilized to the extent that the doctors were happy to plan the skin grafts that would fix some of the damage that had been done to her face and the rest of her body. Elijah had refused to leave her side, so Milton had arranged for him to have a spare bed in a suite that was held back for relatives. He made sure that the boy ate and did whatever he could to reassure him that his mother would make a recovery, although he kept some of the information to himself. The doctors were confident that they would be able to help, but she had been very badly burnt, they said, and she was always going to be badly scarred. On the sixth day, Sharon was moved from the burns unit to a general ward, and Milton started to feel more confident that things would start to improve. He had returned to the hospital after disposing of business. He said nothing about it to Rutherford, but he didn't need to. The story was on the news that night, buried beneath the clamour of the riots, but once the streets had calmed down again, it rose to the top of the bulletins. Business, referred to by his given name of Israel Brown, had been murdered by a person or persons unknown. Two of his associates had also been shot and killed. It was quickly dismissed as a gangland argument that had escalated into something more. Business was revealed to be a man of many enemies and, when it all came down to it, not many friends. It was difficult to find anyone who was prepared to say that he would be missed. Milton had been ready to find a hotel, but Rutherford told him there was no need for that. He could stay with him. Eventually, Milton had agreed. There was a long list of things that needed to be done to make the hall more suitable for the club's business, and staying nearby enabled him to start earlier and finish later. Rutherford had a small house with two bedrooms, the second used as the office from where he ran the club. There was a sofa bed, and once the desk was pushed to the wall, there was enough space for Milton and the handful of things he had rescued from the rented house. They had spoken about Elijah, and once he was ready to leave the hospital, Rutherford had promised that he would be able to stay too. Milton doubted that there would be space for all three of them, but he knew that that was moot. He didn't plan to stay for much longer. Milton had quickly settled into a routine. He would rise early at 5:30 and go for his run. He would work until 8:00, and then, after showering at the club, he would drive across to the hospital to see Elijah and Sharon. After an hour with them, he would return to Hackney and work through until 5:00, stopping only to buy his lunch from the arcade of takeaways at the end of the road. He stayed at the hospital for a second time until visiting closed for the night, worked until 9 or 10, and then, finally, returned to the house for something to eat. Rutherford would usually be watching the television, and he would join him for 30 minutes before calling it a day. It was a hard schedule, but it had allowed him to get a lot done. He had fixed the roof properly, replacing the tiles that had been dislodged. He had given the equipment a thorough cleanse, scrubbing the canvases in both rings until the stains that had been trodden in over the years of use had been mostly scoured away. He had whitewashed the walls and mended the damaged fixtures in the toilets. Rutherford approached him.
You're coming?
In a couple of hours. I want to finish wiring the plugs. The biggest task left to do was to renew the wiring, but he had made a start and was keen to press on.
You work too hard.
It'll get done sooner this way.
I'm still not sure why you're being so good about this.
It's nice to be able to help, he said. I'll see you later.
Aye,
he said, clapping Milton on the back. Rutherford went to collect his coat. Milton was about to fetch his tools from the office when Elijah stepped in front of him.
Hey,
he said a little awkwardly.
All right, Elijah? Thanks for coming.
Are you kidding? I loved it.
I said you'd be cut out for this, didn't I?
He paused awkwardly.
I never said thanks.
Milton smiled at him.
There's no need.
It was...
You know, you don't have to say anything.
I didn't handle things as well as I could have done either. That's how things get to be sometimes. Elijah was struggling for the words.
It's just... I don't want you to think I'm ungrateful, that's all.
You've done well. That fight tonight, the way you handled him, I'm telling you, Elijah, that was something. I know a little bit about boxing, and when Rutherford says you've got potential, I reckon he's about right. You keep working hard and stay away from the street, I'd say there's a very good chance you're going to end up doing something pretty useful with these.
He tapped the back of the boy's hands.
That left hook of yours,
he exhaled theatrically.
It's something, Elijah, it really is. I wouldn't want to get on the other side of it.
Your mother will be proud of you when she sees what you've been doing.
The mention of Sharon quietened him for a moment. You know she'll be all right, Milton said. He looked up at him.
Why did you help us? You never said.
His eyes were met. Milton didn't know how to answer that.
Jaja,
Rutherford called. The three of them were the last people in the hall.
I want a curry, you come in.
Elijah hadn't taken his eyes off Milton's face. It was his turn to feel discomforted.
Doesn't have to be a reason, does there?
Elijah paused for a moment and then reached out his hand. Milton took it and held it for a moment.
See you later, Milton,
the boy said. He self-consciously scrubbed the back of his hand across his damp eyes.
We're getting takeout curries. What do you want?
You choose, I'm not fussed.
You like it hot?
Not really.
Elijah grinned.
Pussy.
Milton watched the boy make his way back to Rutherford. They made their way out, shutting the door behind them. Milton headed to the back and the small office. There was a desk, a filing cabinet, and a battered leather sofa. He collected his bag of tools and went over to the plug that he was fitting. A curry with them sounded good. He was planning on leaving tomorrow, and it would be nice to have had an evening with them before he did. Chapter 53. Rutherford and Elijah walked along the perimeter of the park. all the boy wanted to do was recount the fight from earlier, constantly asking Rutherford for his opinion and his suggestions for how he could eliminate his faults. It made him smile to see the boy so animated. The evening had been an escape for him, Rutherford could see that, a distraction that meant that he didn't have to think about his mother or the ordeal of the last few days. He was a lively, engaged boy, and in his enthusiasm, Rutherford could see the premature aging endowed by the street quickly peeled back. He saw him for what he was, a sweet 15-year-old boy full of the usual insecurities, the usual need for encouragement and acceptance. He was a little full of himself at times, but what young boy wasn't? Rutherford remembered that he had been much worse.
"Damn it,"
Rutherford said. "What's the matter?"
"I put the alarm on. Milton will set it off if he opens the door."
"Want me to run back and tell him?"
"No, I better do it."
He handed over a set of keys and pointed.
"No need for you to come to. We're nearly there. You know my house? Last one on the left. Let yourself in, make yourself at home. I'll get the takeaway on the way back. What you want?"
"Curry," he said. "Milton too. Chicken korma for him, beef madras for me."
"Two chicken kormas and a beef madras then. There are DVDs in the living room. Put one on if you want. Go on, get inside. Don't hang about outside, yeah? It still ain't right around here."
Rutherford waited until Elijah had crossed the road and was at the door to the maisonette. The door opened and closed, the boy disappearing inside. Satisfied, Rutherford turned on his heel and retraced his steps back to the church hall. Chapter 54. Milton put down his screwdriver and concentrated on the aches and pains that registered around his body. His joints throbbed with a dull ague. His muscles felt stiff, and there was a deep-seated fatigue all the way in the marrow of his bones. There was no point in pretending. He was getting old. Old and stiff. He recognised dimly that he needed sleep more than anything else. He was screwing the cover onto the new socket when he heard a knock on the door from outside. He waited, wondering whether he had misheard, but the knock was repeated. 3 times. Quite hard, urgent. He stood. His eye fell on his Sig Sauer, hanging in the shoulder holster against the back of the nearby chair. There was no need. It was Rutherford, or, in the worst case, kids who were mucking about. He tossed it behind the ring, out of sight. He crossed the wide space to the front door, unlocked it, and pulled it back. Milton didn't recognise the man outside. The man brought up a gun and pointed it directly at his chest. "Back inside," he said. The gun was a Sig Sauer 9mm like his own. He knew what that meant.
"About time," he said. "Inside. Control sent you."
The man didn't answer.
"I don't think I've seen you before. Who are you? 11? 12?
12, he said. The muzzle was aimed at his heart, unwavering in a steady hand, and the man's face was blank and inscrutable. There would be no sense in appealing to his better nature. He would have no better nature. 12 followed him into the hall and pushed the door closed with his foot. Milton assessed him. He looked like an athlete with wide shoulders and a tapered trunk. The eyes stared out coldly from beneath pale lashes. They were opaque. Almost dead, the eyes of a drowned man. "What's this about?"
"Are you armed?"
12 said. His voice was flat, the sentence trailing away on a dead note.
"No."
"Pull up your shirt." Milton did as he was told.
"Turn around."
He did.
"Where is it?"
"In the car."
"Anyone else here?"
"Nope. Just me." "Why don't you tell me what this is all about?" Again, there was no response. Milton assessed. Was there any way of putting 12 off his stride, upsetting his balance? He knew with grim certainty that there was not. 12 and all the other young agents in Group 15 were brutally professional. Milton knew how well he had been trained. He would have gone through the same program as he had, after all, and he was able to anticipate all of the variables that he would be considering. First, he would assess the threat that Milton posed, significant but limited as it stood. Second, he would confirm that the surroundings were suitable for an elimination. Perfect. Once those quick assessments had been made to his satisfaction, he would carry out his orders. It would be quick and efficient. Milton guessed that he had a handful of seconds, a minute if he was lucky and could muddy the waters. He would not go down without a fight. If there was a chance, a half chance, he would take it. He assessed the situation himself. 6 feet separated him from 12. Another indication that the agent was good, not enough to compromise his aim, but enough to make sure that Milton could not attack before he could fire. Milton explored his own body, his posture, tensing his muscles and assessing how quickly he might be able to move, the position of his feet, the angle of his hips, of his shoulders. He would need to be decisive, but even then, he knew that his chances were slim. He would certainly be shot before he could reach him, and even if he was not, he did not fancy his chances in unarmed combat with 12. He was younger, his muscles more pliant and less damaged and scarred than Milton's. "Control sent you?" he asked again, probing for a weakness, some conversational gambit he could spin out into hesitation, then work the hesitation into doubt. Nothing. He took a step into the hall. The gun did not waver.
"He doesn't trust me."
Nothing.
"Come on, 12, I'm owed a reason."
Finally, he answered the question.
"Your mental health is in question."
"Don't be ridiculous."
12's eyes darted left and right, taking in his surroundings, scanning for threats.
"Look at this place. What are you now, a handyman?"
Milton ignored that.
"It might have been in question before, but it isn't now. 10 years doing what we do, it's enough to make you hate the world. I'm not doing it anymore. I'm finished. I've never been more certain of anything in my life."
12 turned his gaze back onto Milton.
"I used to look up to you,"
he said, a cruel smile briefly creasing his alabaster white skin.
"You were a legend. But that was then, wasn't it? Before whatever it is that's happened to you. Is that what Control thinks? That I've gone mad? I've been following you. Moving into that dump of a place down the road. That woman you've been seeing. And going to those meetings. You're saying you're an alcoholic now. With all the intelligence you're privy to. Fuck! After what happened in France, what do you think he'd think? How could he possibly let that stand? You have been classified as a security risk. Most urgent, marked for death. What else did you expect? He can't have you running around like that, can he? You're a liability."
He tried to think of something that might deflect 12 from his mission, but there was nothing.
"There's no need for this," he said hopelessly.
"Comes to us all in the end, and I can't lie, this will be the making of me. I'm the one who gets to retire the famous number one."
Behind them, the door handle pressed down. Milton saw it first, an advantage of a second or two that his body spent readying itself for sudden action. 12 heard it too, and the gun continuing to cover Milton, he took a sideways step and then a quarter turn, allowing him to see both Milton and the doorway at the same time. The door opened inwards. Rutherford stood there. Oh no. A warning caught in Milton's throat, stifled by the steady gun.
"Forgot to tell you about the alarm,"
Rutherford said, the sentence trailing away as he noticed the tension in Milton's posture. His face creased with confusion as he looked to the right at 12, and then that became anxiety as he saw the gun.
"Come inside and shut the door,"
12 instructed him in the same cold, flat voice. Milton knew Rutherford had seconds to live. He was a witness, and there could be no witnesses. He had to act right now, but the gun remained where it was, as if held by a statue, pointed implacably at his heart. Rutherford did as he was told, stepping inside and pushing the door behind him. The mechanism closed with a solid click.
"You don't need to shoot him,"
Milton said, desperately trying to distract 12 from the course he would already have determined the moment Rutherford set his hand on the door.
"He doesn't know who you are. He doesn't know who I am. Let him go. We can settle this between us."
"We're going to settle it," 12 said. He swung the gun away from Milton and aimed it at Rutherford. Chapter 55. In one violent corkscrew of motion, Milton threw himself across the room. The gun spat out once and then swung back towards Milton again. 12's reflexes were unbelievably quick, and a second unaimed shot rang out. The bullet caught Milton in the shoulder, razor shards of pain lancing down his arm. Milton disregarded it, shut it down, and threw himself into the younger man. He tackled him around the waist, his momentum sending them both stumbling backwards until they clattered against the wall. 12 tried to bludgeon him with the butt of the gun, but he blocked the clumsy swipe, their wrists clashing and the gun falling to the floor. They collapsed downwards, Milton ending up on top, and he drove the point of his elbow into 12's face. He felt the bones of his nose crumple and snap as they crunched together, blood immediately running over the pale white skin. Milton rolled away and scrambled for the gun. His fingers closed around it as 12 sprang to his feet, his face twisted with fury.
"Don't!"
Milton said. The pain from his shoulder washed over him in nauseous waves, but he managed to aim the pistol. 12 stopped. He was 6 feet away. Blood ran freely from his broken nose. His eyes shone with anger. Milton slowly got to his feet. His left shoulder felt as though it had been mangled, the arm hanging uselessly down by his side. He was woozy from the pain. He knew from experience that it would get worse. It was the adrenaline that was holding him together, but the pain would overwhelm him eventually. He held the advantage, but he would not have it for long. "Put the gun down," 12 said. Milton looked across the room. Rutherford's body was sprawled across the floor. 12's shot had struck him in the forehead. He had landed in an untidy sprawl, his arms outflung, his body was still. There was no hope for him. Milton tightened his grip on the pistol. He felt the old familiar flick of his anger. His finger tightened around the trigger. "Put it down," 12 said calmly. He tried to tune out the pain. 12 had sunk down a little, spreading his weight between both legs. He could see that Milton was injured. He would have noticed the way that his aim was slowly dropping, his gun arm gradually falling towards the floor. He would be making the same calculations that Milton had made moments earlier. The distance between them, how quickly he could close it, the odds of a shot stopping him before he could reach his target. Milton knew his weakness was obvious. 12 would be able to smell it like a shark smells blood. Milton fought the anger and the pain.
"I'm not going to kill you," he said, his voice quiet. "I'm finished with that. Not unless there's no other choice. And if you're sensible, you won't back me into a corner."
"All right," 12 said, showing him his open palms, placating him.
"I won't. Take it easy."
"I'm not going to kill you. But you know I can't have you following me."
Milton stiffened his arm, switched to a lower aim, and pulled the trigger. The bullet struck 12 in the right knee. His face distorted with agony, and he fell back. Milton closed in and swept his good leg. 12 dropped to the floor. Milton backed away, covering him with the gun until he reached the door.
"Tell Control not to come after me."
"He'll come after you,"
he gasped through the pain.
"Tell him I'm out."
12 grunted. Milton realized that he was laughing.
"We're never out."
"I am. Tell him if he sends anyone after me, I'll send them back in boxes and then I'll bring him down."
He looked again at Rutherford's unmoving body, then at 12, staring up at him through a mask of pain. He reached around and pushed the gun into the waistband of his jeans and pulled out the tails of his shirt to cover it. The pain was reaching a crescendo. He had to move now. Right now. He opened the door and hurried across the road towards the unlit stretch of park. He passed through the open gate and kept going until the darkness swallowed him. Chapter 56. The house was empty. Milton had forced his way in through a door to the garden. He'd put his fist through the glass and unlocked the door from the inside. It was one of the most expensive streets in the neighbourhood, a long, curved cul-de-sac that faced onto the peaceful expanse of a common adjacent to the main area of the park. Expensive SUVs and 4x4s competed for space on the road. The houses were large, set behind railed front gardens with wide bay windows and broad front doors. Milton had started to feel faint as he crossed the common. The pain had started to dull and fade, a sensation he knew was dangerous. He kept his hand clamped to his shoulder, but the blood kept coming. He knew enough about battlefield medicine to know that a lodged bullet could sometimes be a blessing, plugging up the entry wound until it could be carefully removed and the blood staunched. Milton had not been so fortunate. This bullet had nicked a vein, and the blood continued to seep out around it, squeezing through his fingers and soaking into the fabric of his shirt. He found a packet of ibuprofen in a first aid box in the bathroom cabinet. He tapped out three and swallowed them dry, and then laid out his tools on the kitchen table. He placed an adjustable mirror before the chair and stood an angle-poise lamp next to it. The shade turned so that the bright cone of light was cast back onto the chair. He opened the first aid box again and took out a tube of antiseptic gel, a gauze dressing, and a roll of bandages. He crossed the room to the gas hob and removed the small kitchen knife from where he had rested it, the blade suspended in the blue flame. He raised the knife before his cheek. The metal glowed red and radiated heat. That was good. He lodged the blade of a larger, broader metal spatula in the flame instead. He went back to the table and took off his shirt, using it to mop the blood from around the wound. He sat in the wooden chair, adjusting the lamp so that its light fell on the wound, and then turned the mirror so that he could stare right into it. A neat hole had been burrowed out, blackened around the edges and scabbed in parts with partly congealed blood. He grimaced with pain as he reached his left hand back up to his left shoulder and then gasped as he used his forefinger and thumb to spread the edges of the wound, opening it so that he could look a little way inside. He took the knife and, biting down hard on a dishcloth, prodded the hot and sharp tip into the wound, digging deeper until he saw the silver sparkle of the bullet lodged like a spiteful tumour an inch deep in his flesh. He took a deep breath and pushed the knife further into his flesh, the sharp point sliding through the skin and into the muscle beneath. The pain yanked him back to wakefulness and then kept climbing. Every millimetre of progress, every nudge and tap, was rewarded with a lance of agony that seared into his brain. He thought about Elijah and Sharon. He thought about Rutherford. He felt the tip of the blade touch against the bullet, and with the pain and his weakness shimmering like heat haze before his face, he pressed down harder and then prized the blade back, levering the slug from its burrow and pressing it out until it dropped from out of the wound and onto the table. The pain flared once, a crescendo that Milton met by slamming his fist against the table and then slackened off. Halfway there. He swallowed another two ibuprofen and reached over to the hob for the spatula. Closing his eyes and pressing his teeth together, he took the blade and pressed it against the wound, the skin sizzling as the red-hot metal cauterized it. Milton gasped at another vicious wave of pain, clenching the edge of the table until it, too, passed. He inspected the seared, puckered flesh in the mirror. A huge purple bruise had already bloomed around the wound, but the bleeding had stopped. He had done a decent job. There was no time to pause. Milton went upstairs and stripped off, taking 12 Sig Sauer into the bathroom with him and showered in the ensuite bathroom. He dried himself, daubing antiseptic gel onto the clean wound and then dressing it with the gauze pad, fixing it in place with the roll of bandage. He went into the bedroom and tore through the wardrobe, finding a t-shirt and jeans that fitted him and putting them on. He had noticed a key fob on the radiator cover in the hall. The fob was attached to a leather swatch decorated with a BMW badge. He left the house through the front door, his pistol hidden beneath a leather jacket he had taken from where it had been slung over the end of the banister. He aimed the fob at the line of parked cars and pressed. There came the familiar double blip and the illumination of the courtesy lights of a large black BMW X5 that had been parked a little way down the road. Milton opened the door and slid inside. He put 12's pistol on the passenger seat and pressed the engine start. The display reported a full tank of diesel. He let the handbrake out, put the car into gear, and pulled slowly into the quiet road.
Epilogue. Chapter 57. Pinky took a seat on the seesaw and looked around. They were in the playground next to Blissett House. He looked up at the sixth floor. The fire had been contained there, but Elijah's old flat and the ones on each side had been gutted. Black ash and soot were everywhere. The windows and doors had been boarded up, the damage sticking out like an ugly bruise on the concrete face of the block. Pinky didn't have strong feelings about what had happened. Elijah and his mums had brought it on themselves. What else was business supposed to have done? The two of them sending that man after him like that. Pinky had no sympathy for them. He had sent messages to the other boys, and they had been waiting for him when he had arrived 5 minutes earlier. They were all there. Little Mark, Chips, kids, and a couple of the primary school kids from the estate who had been hanging around with him for the last week. Time they got promoted, Pinky thought. Time they had something useful to do. The boys were spread out. Chips and Kid sat on the swings. Little Mark leant against the chain-link fence. The youngsters kept together, eyeing the older boys with a mixture of bravado and nervousness. The older boys were smoking from the joint that Pinky had rolled and passed around. It had been a crazy few days, and Pinky had not slept much. It didn't matter, though. He still felt good. There was no point in pretending that he hadn't been frightened, but nothing had happened to him, and now he was in the clear. He had searched the studio after Milton had left. He figured he had a little time before the feds came, and he knew that there was bound to be stuff worth taking. He had been right about that. He had found more than 10 grand in a holdall and dozens of little bags filled with cocaine, ready to be distributed to businesses' dealers, the network of shotters that he had on the street. Pinky had put the Mac-10s and the drugs into another bag he found and left the studio by the fire escape at the back. It had been hairy getting back. London had been a war zone that night, police cars and vans speeding through the back streets under blue lights, but he had not been stopped. He had stored the guns and money under his bed at home, hiding it beneath his empty trainer boxes and dirty clothes. His mums had given up trying to get him to keep the room tidy long ago, and she had stopped going inside. He knew they would be safe there for a day or two, until he could think of somewhere better. Pinky cast his gaze around the group. They all knew Pops was gone, but no one had said anything about it. Pinky guessed that they had heard that he was responsible, and, while he wasn't stupid enough to admit that it had been him, he was happy for them to speculate. He wouldn't own up to it, but he wouldn't deny it either. A little bit of fear was a good thing, especially with what he had planned. It helped to build respect. That had been a long time coming, and he was going to make sure that he took advantage of it. Pinky reckoned that he had been given an opportunity. After always being second best, now he had a chance to really do something with his life. Make a name for himself, make some money. He wasn't going to fuck it up. No way. He got up from the seesaw.
Aye,
he said.
First things first. I'm in charge now. Anyone have a problem with that?
No one spoke.
Didn't think so.
He grinned. He lifted the holdall onto the roundabout and pulled back the zip. Dozens of little bags full of white powder were snuggled together inside.
Pay attention,
he said, making sure that they had all seen the stash.
Things are going to change around here. We're going to make some mad cash. I'm going into business, boys. If you got the balls to be a part of it, listen up. This is what we're going to do.
Chapter 58. Group 15 had its own private medical facilities attached to a well-known London teaching hospital. State-of-the-art facilities, the best doctors in the country, absolute discretion. Control watched through the window as the surgeon bent low to examine the damage that had been done to 12's knee. The man and his three colleagues were wearing green smocks, their faces covered by surgical masks and latex gloves over their hands. 12 had been anaesthetised and was laid out on the operating table, covered by a sheet with a long vertical slit that allowed easy access to his right leg. The surgeon had already sliced open his knee, a neat incision that began just below the quadriceps and curved around the line of his leg. The opening was held open by medical clips, and a miniature camera on an articulated arm had been positioned overhead, its feed visible on the large screen that was fixed to the wall in the observation suite. Milton's bullet had ruined the knee, smashing through the anterior and posterior ligaments and shattering the patella. They had examined the damage with an arthroscope first and determined that repairs were not possible. A full arthroplasty was necessary. The surgeon had removed what was left of the patella and had shaved the ends of the femur and tibia so that he could fix the replacement joint. One of his colleagues was preparing the bone cement while the other was checking that the prosthesis was ready to be implanted. Control watched the screen, his eyes a little glazed. He was not bothered by the blood and the gore. Heaven knows he had seen enough of it over the years, and much worse than this. He was not really concentrating on 12 at all. His mind was on Milton. His liquidation should have been straightforward. 12 had had the benefit of surprise, and Milton was not as young as he had once been. And yet, here they were, with a badly injured agent, and Milton a ghost. He had been working on damage control ever since 12 had limped out of the church hall and called for emergency pickup. He had taken the response team himself to ensure that there was no trace of 12 ever having been there. The blood from his leg had been scrubbed away and footage from local CCTV cameras had been deleted. The dead man, Rutherford, was left where he was. 12 had explained what had happened. The surprise of Rutherford's appearance had saved Milton's life, so now, in death, he would have to pay back the damage that he had caused. His body would prove to be useful. It was easy to fabricate the story. CCTV footage placed Milton at the scene and showed Rutherford arriving moments before he was shot. A camera at the entrance to the park had footage of Milton heading north. He was wounded too, a bullet to the shoulder. They had immediately checked local hospitals for admissions, but it was perfunctory. Milton was much too savvy to do something as foolish as that. An hour later, they had intercepted a call to local police of a break-in. A couple had returned to their house on the edge of the nearby park to find that someone had forced the door to the garden. Their car and a few clothes had been stolen. That in itself would have been enough for control to have investigated, but they had also reported that their first aid cabinet had been ransacked, that a lamp had been moved onto the kitchen table, and that kitchen utensils had been found covered in blood. Control took command of the investigation himself and visited the house. He went through into the kitchen and sat at the table, glancing at his reflection. He knew that Milton had been sitting in the same chair a couple of hours earlier. He had operated on himself. cleaned the wound, and made it safe until he found someone that he could trust to do the job properly. He had showered, changed clothes, taken their car, and fled. The police were looking for the vehicle, but they had not located it yet. It wouldn't matter. They would find it eventually, abandoned at the side of the road when Milton switched vehicles. It would be too late then. He would stay ahead of them unless he made a mistake or he chose to be found. Control focused on the screen again as the prosthesis was carefully placed into 12's wrecked joint. John Milton was a chameleon. He had 20 years' experience of blending into the background, surfacing only to do the bloody work of his trade before sinking out of sight again. Control felt an icy knot in the pit of his stomach. Milton was the most dangerous man he had ever met, and now he knew that the state wanted him dead. He had no idea what he would do next, and that was the kind of thought that would keep a man up at night. Chapter 59. The motorway stretched away into the distance, the slow-moving row of taillights painting a lazy swipe across the valley. There had been a crash outside Wolverhampton, and the traffic had backed up, filtering slowly through two lanes while the grim wreckage was craned away. Milton cursed the accident. He knew that it would only be a matter of time before the details of the stolen BMW were added to the National Registry. The motorway was equipped with the CCTV masts that serviced the police's number plate recognition system, and the longer he stayed on the road, the greater the chance that the car would be noticed. He felt vulnerable, and even though he knew it would make no difference, he tugged down the brim of the baseball cap he had found in the glove compartment so that his face was partially obscured. He was tired, and his shoulder throbbed. He had been driving for 3 hours. His instinct was not to stop until he reached Manchester, but as he passed the sign advertising the services at Stafford South, he decided it was worth the risk for a strong cup of coffee. Milton moved carefully into the crawler lane and pulled off the motorway. The car park was quiet, a wide open space lit by a series of tall overhead lights. Milton parked in a shadowed area and walked across to the complex of buildings. There were very few drivers around, a handful of red-eyed travellers drinking coffee in the small Starbucks concession. Milton bought a packet of Nurofen from W.H. Smith and then ordered a double espresso and a bottle of water from the bored-looking barista. Milton looked up at the screen fixed to the wall. The BBC's rolling news channel was showing. He sipped from the styrofoam cup as the anchor recapped the day's news. The riots were the main focus, the worst of the disturbances had abated, but the police were short-handed, and there was talk of calling in the army. Milton was stunned by their severity. Large parts of Croydon had been set alight, and a furniture store that he recognised had been razed to the ground by a ferocious blaze. There was footage from Hackney and Tottenham, crowds of rioters with scarves obscuring their faces, packs of looters that descended on retail parks and local businesses alike, taking whatever they could lay their hands upon. A police superintendent was interviewed and promised that the culprits would be caught and punished. Milton thought of Elijah. Had they got to him in time? And in other news, police have launched a murder hunt after a man was found dead in the boxing club he ran in London's East End. Dennis Rutherford was found this evening by one of his students. He had been shot. A picture of Rutherford was displayed. He was with a group of youngsters, holding a trophy and smiling into the camera. The picture switched to an outside broadcast. A reporter was standing in front of the boxing club, a policeman standing guard at the entrance. The reporter spoke into the camera. The Metropolitan Police and London Ambulance Service were called here at 10:20 p.m, where the victim from Hackney was subsequently pronounced dead. A post-mortem is due to take place tomorrow, but it is understood that he died from a single gunshot wound. Police sources say they want to speak to John Milton, last seen in the London area. He is described as a middle-aged white male, 6 foot tall, well-built and with short dark hair.
They recommend that he is not approached and that members of the public with information on his whereabouts should contact officers as soon as possible. A head and shoulders picture of Milton flashed onto the screen. He recognised it. The picture had been taken from his group file. Control was behaving exactly as he knew that he would. He would organise a manhunt, co-opting all the other agencies, the intelligence service, the police, everyone. His picture remained on the screen as the report continued. Milton looked around at the other customers anxiously. No one was paying the television much attention, but he replaced the cap on his head regardless. He took his coffee with him and went back out into the hot night. The steady hum of the motorway was loud, the stand of trees that had been planted at the edge of the car park doing little to dampen the noise. Milton ignored the BMW. It had served him well, but he knew that it would have been reported by now. He found a spot that was poorly served by CCTV and approached a Ford Mondeo. He forced the door, slid inside, and hot-wired the engine. The digital clock on the dashboard showed a little after 3 a.m. as he rejoined the motorway heading north. He passed through the gears, making sure to stay below the speed limit. In 1.5 hours, the lights of Liverpool sparkled in the distance. Milton turned off the motorway and drove into town. Thank you for listening to The Cleaner by Mark Dawson, read by David Thorpe. Keep listening for the first chapter of the next book in the series, Saint Death by Mark Dawson, read by David Thorpe. Saint Death, a John Milton novel, by Mark Dawson, read by David Thorpe. Put on the whole armour of the God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Because we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Ephesians, chapter 6, verses 11 to 17. Prologue. Samalayuca, south of Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Adolfo González lowered his AK, and the others did the same. They were stood in a semicircle, all around the 3 stalled trucks. There was no noise beyond the soporific buzz of the earth baking and cracking under the heat of the sun. Dust and heat shimmered everywhere. He looked out at their handiwork. The vehicles were smoking. Bullet holes studded all the way across the sheet metal. They were all shot up to high heaven. The windscreens had been staved in by the 416 caliber rounds that the snipers had fired. Some of the holes that ran across the cars were spaced and regular from the AKs, others were scattered with uneven clumps from number 4 buckshot. The Italians had come to the meet in their big, expensive 4-wheel drive Range Rovers, tinted windows, leather interiors, and xenon headlamps. Trying to make a big impression, showing off. Hadn't done them much good. One of them had tried to drive away, but he hadn't got far. The tyres of the car were flat, still wheezing air. The glass was all shot out. Steam poured from the perforated bonnets. Adolfo looked up at the hills. He knew Samalayuca like the back of his hand. His family had been using this spot for years, perfect for dumping bodies, perfect for ambushes. He put 3 of his best snipers up on the lava ridge, 0.5 miles away. They had prepared covered trenches and hidden them overnight. He could see them coming down the ridge now. The sun shone against the dark metal of their long-barreled Barretts and reflected in glaring flickers from the glass in the sights. He approached the nearest Range Rover, his automatic cradled at his waist. Things happened. Miracles. It paid to be careful. He opened the door. One of the Italians, slumped dead over the wheel, swung over to the side. Adolfo hauled his body out and dumped it in the dust. Bad luck, pendejo. There were 2 more bodies in the back. Adolfo walked around the end of the truck. There was another body behind it, face up, mouth open. Vivid red blood soaked into the dirt. A cloud of hungry flies hovered over it. He went to the second truck and looked through the window at the driver. This one had tried to get away. He was shot through the head, blood everywhere, the dash, the seats, across what was left of the window. He walked on to the third vehicle. Two men inside, both dead. He walked back to the first truck to where the body lay. He nudged the man's ribs with his toe. The man moved his lips.
What?
The man wheezed something at him. Adolfo knelt down.
I can't hear you.
Basta!
The man wheezed.
Ferma!
Too late to stop, cabron,
Adolfo said.
You should have thought of that before.
He put the automatic down and gestured to Pablo. He had the video camera and was taking the footage that they would upload to YouTube later. Leave a message, something to focus the mind. Pablo brought the camera over, still filming. Another man brought over a short-bladed machete. He gave it to him. The dying man followed Adolfo with his eyes. Adolfo signalled, and his men hauled the dying man to his knees. They dragged him across to a tree. There was blood on his face, and it slicked out from the bottom of his jacket. They looped a rope over a branch and tied one end around the man's ankles. They yanked on the other end so that he fell to his knees, and then they yanked again, and then again, until he was suspended upside down. Adolfo took the machete with his right hand and, with his left, took a handful of the man's thick black hair and yanked back to expose his throat. Adolfo stared into the camera. He went to work. Day 1. The City of Lost Girls. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Second Book of Timothy, chapter 4, verse 7. From redacted to redacted. Date, Monday, September the 16th, 5:21 p.m. Subject, cartwheel. Dear Foreign Secretary, at our meeting last week, you requested sight of a report detailing the circumstances in which the agent responsible for the botched assassination in the French Alps has disappeared. I attach a copy of that report to this email. While writing, please allow me to reiterate that all efforts are being made to locate and recover this agent. He will not be easy to find for the reasons that we discussed, but please do be assured that he will not be able to stay undetected forever. If there is any follow-up once you have considered this report, please do as ever let me know. Sincerely, M. Begins. Eyes only. Code G15. Publication, analysis, background. Description, not applicable. Attribution, internal. Distribution, alpha. Special handling, orange. Codename, cartwheel. Summary. Following the unsatisfactory elimination of the Iranian nuclear scientists Yahya Moussa and Samira Najib, John Milton, a.k.a. G15 No. 1, a.k.a. John Smith, a.k.a. Cartwheel, the agent responsible, has gone AWOL. Location presently undetermined. Milton is extremely dangerous and must be recovered without delay. Analysis. Extracted. Control records that Milton evinced a desire to leave the service on returning to London following the completion of his assignment in France. The meeting is said to have been heated and ended with Milton being put on suspension prior to a full assessment and review. Redacted. His subsequent behaviour was observed to be erratic. He began to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, almost certainly in contravention of his obligations under the Official Secrets Act. He rented a house in a poor part of Hackney, East London, and is believed to have become emotionally involved with a single mother, Sharon Warriner. Our investigations are ongoing, but it is believed that he was attempting to assist Ms. Warriner's son, Elijah, who is believed to have been on the fringes of a local gang. We suspect that Milton was involved in the death of Israel Brown, the successful rapper who performed under the nom de plume of Risky Business, whom we understand to have been the prime mover in the relevant gang. Redacted. The order to decommission Milton was given on Monday the 15th of August. A second G-15 agent, Christopher Callan, aka G-15, number 12, Tripwire, had located Milton at a boxing club set up for local children by a Mr. Dennis Rutherford. As Callan was preparing to carry out his orders, he was disturbed by Mr. Rutherford. In the confusion that followed, Callan killed Mr. Rutherford and shot Milton in the shoulder. This was, unfortunately, not sufficient to subdue him, and he was able to overpower Callan, shooting him in the knee to prevent pursuit, and then make his escape. ANPR located him driving a stolen car northwards. The last sighting was on the M62 heading into Liverpool. The working hypothesis is that he boarded a ship to leave the country. Redacted. Analysis of Milton's psychological assessments, attached, suggests that his mental state has been deteriorating for some time. Feelings of guilt are not uncommon in Group 15 operatives, and Milton has worked there for a decade. It is regrettable that warning signs were missed, but perhaps understandable. Milton's performance has always been superb. He was perhaps the most effective of all our operatives. Subsequent analysis has led us to the conclusion that he is suffering from insomnia, depression, and possible re-experiencing of past events. PTSD is a fashionable diagnosis to make, but it is one that we are now reasonably confident is accurate. Regardless of his mental condition, Milton is far too dangerous to be ignored. He was a key part of several key British and NATO intelligence successes, not all of which have been reported in the press, and his value to the enemy is difficult to assess. The damage that he could do by going public is similarly incalculable. Ends. From redacted to redacted. Date, Wednesday, September the 19th, 5:21 p.m. Subject, re-cartwheel.
Dear M, thank you for the report. I have shared it with the PM, who is not, as you might well imagine, best pleased with its contents. You are to convey his displeasure to Control personally, and to remind him that it is of the highest importance that Mr. Milton is located. We simply cannot have a man with his skills and knowledge running around outside of the reservation, as our American cousins would undoubtedly say. I am not sure which grubby little euphemism our mutual friend would prefer, but let's settle on retirement. All due haste, please. Regards, etc., James.
Chapter 1. John Milton got off the bus and walked into the parking lot of the first restaurant that he found. It was a hot day, baking hot, brutally hot, the noon sun battering down on Ciudad Juarez as if it bore a grudge. The sudden heat hit him like a steelyard furnace. The restaurant was set back from the road, behind a wide parking lot, the asphalt shimmering like the water in an aquarium. A large sign, suspended from a tall pole, announced the place as La Casa del Mole. It was well located, on Col Chavana, and near to a highway off-ramp, just a few miles to the border from here, plenty close enough for the place to snag daring Americans coming south for a true taste of La Vida Loca. There were half a dozen similar places all around it, brightly painted, practically falling to bits, garish neon signs left on day and night, a handful of cars parked haphazardly in the lot. Awful places, dreadful food, and not the sort of establishment that Milton would have chosen to visit. But They churned through the staff so fast that they were always looking for replacements, and they didn't tend to be too picky about who they hired. Ex-cons, vagabonds, vagrants, it didn't matter. And there would be no questions asked, so long as you could cook. Milton had worked in places like this all the way up through Mexico. He knew that they appealed to tourists and the uncritical highway trade, and that this one in particular was still in business for three main reasons. It was better advertised than the tumble-down shacks and chain restaurants around it. The parking lot was big enough that it would be almost impossible to fill, and the daily seafood special was just $19.95, $3 cheaper than the seafood special of any of the nearby competitors. Milton had worked in a place in Mazatlan until he had had to move on 2 weeks ago, and he was willing to bet that this would be just the same. The special would be the same every day. Cold crab salad, made with a cheap fish, not crab. A fried fillet of haddock that was just about on the turn. A couple of crab legs, a fruit cup, and half an onion instead of a baked potato. It would do him just fine. He crossed the parking lot and went inside. The place really was a dive, worse when viewed in the middle of the day, when the light that streamed through the grime-streaked windows revealed the peeling paint, the mice holes in the skirting, and the thick patina of dust that lay over everything. It was 700 miles west to the Pacific and 800 east to the Gulf. But the owner wasn't going to let small details like that dissuade him from the nautical theme he obviously hankered after. A ship's wheel, netting draped down from the walls, fronds of fake seaweed stapled to the net, lobster pots and shrimper's buoys dangling from the ceiling, a fetid and greening aquarium that separated the bar from the cavernous dining room beyond. A woman was sitting at the bar, running a sweating bottle of Corona against the back of her neck. "Hello?" She nodded in response, neither friendly nor hostile. "Do you work here?"
"I ain't here for the good of my health, baby. What you want?"
"Came in to see if you were hiring."
"Depends what you do."
"I cook."
"Don't take this the wrong way, honey. But you don't look like no cook."
"I'm not bad. Give me a chance and I'll show you."
"Ain't me you're gonna have to show."
She turned to the wide-open emptiness of the restaurant and hollered, "Gomez! New blood!" Milton watched as a man came out of the back. He was big, fat and unhealthy, with a huge gut, short arms and legs, and an unshaved, pasty complexion. The T-shirt he was wearing was stretched tight around his barrel chest, and his apron was tied right to the limit of the strings. He smelt bad, unwashed and rancid from rotting food.
"What's your name?"
"Smith."
"You cook?"
"That's right."
"Where?"
"Wherever. I've been travelling up the coast. Ensenada, Mazatlan, Acapulco."
"And then Juarez? Not Tijuana?"
"Tijuana's too big. Too Californian."
"Last stop before America?"
"Maybe, maybe not." "Are you the owner?"
"Near enough for you, cabron." "That accent, what is it? Australian?"
"English. I'm from London." Gomez took a beer from the fridge and cracked it open.
"You want a beer, English?"
"No thanks, I don't drink." Gomez laughed at that, a sudden laugh up from the pit of his gut that wobbled his pendulous rolls of fat, his mouth so wide that Milton could see the black marks of his filled teeth.
"You don't drink, and you say you want to work in my kitchen."
He laughed again, throwing his head all the way back.
"Hombre, you're either stupid or you ain't no cook like what I ever met."
"You won't have any problems with me."
"You work a fryer?"
"Of course. And whatever else you need doing."
Lucky for you, I just had a vacancy come up. My fry cook tripped and put his arm into the fryer all the way up to his elbow last night. Stupid bastardo. out of action for 2 months, they say. So, maybe I give you a spin, see how you get on. 7 an hour, cash.
15.
In another life, compadre. 10. And another 10 says you won't still be here tomorrow.
Milton knew that 10 was the going rate and that he wouldn't be able to advance it. Deal.
When can you start?
Tonight?